Hello and welcome back to Supernatural, where we're on a quest to make the extraordinary ordinary and unlock the greatness that lives in every human being. Thanks for joining us. My guest today is Brian Mirabella. Brian is a human performance specialist and certified master instructor in Oxygen Advantage, Weck Method, and restorative breathing. He works with everyone from CEOs to world-class athletes, bringing together decades of experience to teach people how to live a healthy life and enhance their performance through a holistic approach that involves a species-specific diet, proper breathing and movement patterns, optimizing recovery, and revitalizing the nervous system. And Brian, on a more personal note, it was about 2 years ago now when I noticed my body was not tolerating meat and other heavier foods. And so from there, I moved to a traditional vegetarian. That didn't help me. I went to a cooked vegan from there. I still wasn't feeling good. And at that point, I was kind of freaking out because I've been an athlete my whole life. And so I had it drilled into me. You got to eat protein. You got to eat flesh in order to build muscle. And so I was like, what am I going to eat? Am I going to wither away into skin and bone? But I ended up finding Dr. Morse, and what he was doing really, really resonated with me. And I wanted to find out if there were more people out there who were thriving on this diet. And I think you were the first person that I found after Dr. Morse. Wow. And I bought your $20 webinar on how to transition to a fruit-based lifestyle. And I was off and running from there, and I haven't looked back since. So I just wanted to share that with you and say that this is a conversation I've really been looking forward to because you've impacted my journey in a very profound way. So welcome, and thanks for being here, Brian.
Wow, that is one heck of an intro. Thank you, Chad. It's just beautiful to hear that that simple little program made such an impact for you. So that gives me hope that it's given that much impact for everybody else, whoever purchased it. That's amazing. Wow, that's so cool, really.
Yeah, we impact people in ways that we don't really know, but you have a pretty remarkable story of healing yourself. And so I would love for you to just start there and take us through your journey of how you kind of broke down and rebuilt yourself, particularly the nutrition aspect, because that's where we're going to start with this conversation.
Cool. I just want to say hi to all your listeners out there. Thanks for having me too. Well, I'm about to be 56 years old on Sunday, and I've been an athlete my entire life. I was literally born running. I started walking at 8 months old. My mom said my terrible twos lasted till I was five. There was no stroller for Brian. Brian would not be in a stroller. He had to run and walk everywhere. So I've pretty much been an athlete my whole life, and that's meant the world to me. I don't know if you know much about human design, but I've had my human design read, and I'm literally living the embodiment of my design. So I could have chosen to be a lawyer, but my human design said I should be in health. So now I chose that lifestyle, but along the way, being born in 69 and growing up in the 70s, my mom, she was a single mom, and we didn't have a lot of money. We were living on food stamps back in the 70s. I was wearing all my friends' hand-me-downs. And she was a smoker. And she smoked all through pregnancy. And her mother, who had three children, smoked all through three pregnancies. So we could talk later about this, but the lymphatic system is porous. And whatever chemicals or toxins you ingest, they get stuck in you like a sponge. So I was literally born dirty, because my iridologist, who's a Dr. Morse trained general, Magdalena White, she says my eyes are blue. And I'm like, what? She's like, underneath there, you have blue eyes. But I didn't start really learning from her until about a year ago. Prior to that, I went out on my own and I started learning myself. But let me catch you up, my life. So I was an athlete from the moment I was 5 years old. I was playing baseball, peewee football, got to high school, started playing football, started wrestling. I fell in love with wrestling, but I grew up fighting my whole life, being in the Bronx and being small of stature at only 5'6", which I'm now 5'4 5/8" because wrestling gave me scoliosis, so I shrunk, which we could talk about because now I'm actually decompressing because of what I'm doing now, and I am going to get taller. I'm going to get my height back. And then from college wrestling, I became a personal trainer. So I started lifting weights when I was 13 because my idols were Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Arnold had just won the Olympia in 1980 for the seventh time, and he put out an encyclopedia, so everybody wanted to look like Arnold. We didn't know he was on steroids. So I started lifting weights at 13. So at 13, I was already compressing my spine with linear movements by putting bars on your back and deadlifting and bench pressing and creating this type of motion. And then your spine's just going to get destroyed. And then I wrestled. And I was hurt a lot in wrestling because I already had fascial restrictions happening. As a wrestler, you're spent over, your head is up, so you're never going to breathe completely. You're always going to breathe with your shoulders because you're in a fight or flight you're doing a fight or flight sport because it's painful and it's aggressive. So you're constantly fighting for your life, and that destroys your nervous system. You know, none of the people who are wrestling now realize that because they're young and they feel like they can do anything. But the human body is not, just because it can do something doesn't mean it's supposed to do something.
Right.
And this is what I've come to realize. So then I became a personal trainer and I started really heavily lifting weights. And I wound up squatting in competition 600 pounds, drug-free. I was always tested because I always had this body ripped to shreds. And I was also eating massive amounts of protein. So I grew up eating tons of protein. My mom didn't even breastfeed me. She put me on formula and she smoked. She didn't want to ruin her breasts. Back then, some women thought about it. They didn't want to ruin their breasts for aesthetics. And she didn't want that. So she put me on formula. So I never had the ability to grow right or breathe right. Because I was eating formula. It was creating congestion. I remember being congested my whole entire childhood. I was always at the doctor. When I was 16, I counted how many times I was at the doctor, and it was 113 times. And I was like, I tried figuring that out, and I was like, oh my goodness. I was like, Mom, you brought me here 113 times. And she was like, well, you were sick a lot. And they put me on antibiotics all of those times, probably.
Of course.
So my microbiome was destroyed. But I would say that my growth was stunted in the womb. Right away, I was stunted. And that set me up, that predisposed me to have a lot of issues later in life. But those issues didn't really come in until I was 46 years old. Or actually at 37, I ruptured my biceps tendon 90%. It was only hanging on by a thread. And then 2 years later, I herniated my disc in Bikram yoga. I was already pretty tight from lifting. In Bikram yoga, they're like, go 1 inch further, go 1 inch further, push yourself. I'm an athlete. I'm going to push myself as hard as I can. And I felt it go, ding. And I was like, oh. And you know, pain went away. It wasn't that bad. And then I would do Bikram yoga and I'd have back pain. And the teachers would say, everyone has back pain when they start Bikram. Looking back on that, I'm like, oh my God, that's such horrible teaching. How could you say that to somebody? So I wound up herniating it a little bit more each time. And then I had packages and I went to step off the bus and I misjudged a step. You know, when you misjudge a step and you hit and you go boom, yeah, and your body catches you, which is fascia. When that happened, I heard it in my brain go, and that ruptured, and I was devastated. I was in agony, and that languished for 2.5 years, because my son's stepdad at the time is an orthopedic surgeon, one of the best in the country, and he said, Brian, guys with your MRI are begging me to operate on them. But I had been doing some reading, and I said, well, if a starfish can regrow a leg, then I should be able to heal my back, but I had no idea how. So I tried stretching. So now I'm trying to stretch fascial tissue that doesn't really want to be stretched because it's already been tight and tensed its whole life. Its whole life, right? Up until 39, I'd been strengthening my body without any mental acuity, just constant, you know, pushing myself to the brink of destruction because that's what I think was good for me. That's what athletes are supposed to do. So I had two herniations, an S1 and L5. I wound up, 2.5 years later, I wound up finding The Anatomy Trains by Thomas Myers. I went to a seminar in Cape Cod, and during the seminar, it really hit home with the things that Eli Thompson was saying. And I was like, wow, Eli, should I come to Boston and get work done by you? And he said, I have a better idea. There's a woman in Manhattan where you live, and she's a master teacher, and you should see her. So I started seeing this woman, Simone Lindner, and after the first time, Chad, she's touching me. Now, my legs used to be 26.5 inches. Right now, they're 21. They were enormous, because I wanted to be enormous, and I thought you were supposed to be rock solid. And she said, Brian, this is 13 years ago. She said, you have the tightest fascia I have ever touched. And I go, cool. And she goes, no, Brian, not cool. Your body's not supposed to be rigid like that. But I was just learning, and I had no idea what she was talking about, although I knew I had pain everywhere, especially in my back. So I worked with her for 6 months, and I wasn't really getting much better. And then she said, you should see the chiropractor here in the office. He's a network chiropractor, and he deals with the subconscious. And I'm like, okay, you're telling me to see him, so I'll go see him. I didn't know what that meant. And it turned out that my lower back injury, yeah, it happened through my activity in my life, but it had to do with my mother. And I grew up with a very bipolar mother. And every day of my life was toxic. And she beat me. She cursed at me. She told me I was going to be a piece of shit for the rest of my life. But yet she also loved me unconditionally in moments. So those type of children never know what to expect. Is she going to hit me today? Is she going to love me? And that really does a number on your psyche. So then I was like, what do you mean your subconscious can cause injuries? What the hell does that mean? I didn't know anything about Indian teachings, the Vedas, or the nadis, because in biology class, they don't teach you about energy. They teach you on a biological, biochemical, physical level. You know, in the back of the room, there's the musculoskeletal system poster, the nervous system, the digestive system, and the respiratory system. They don't teach you about the energetic system, the etheric system. I didn't learn that till I was like 43 years old. Right. So I'm seeing the chiropractor, and he said, after being with him for a year, Brian, there's nothing wrong with you anymore. Your back is not injured. Your discs are fine. He was explaining to me that it was my mother, the stress and the anxiety that I held from her. And this was when I was 43. She died when I was 26, which was devastating. I was all on my own. So I had all this trauma emotionally, and then all of the physical trauma I did to myself, and then all the allopathic trauma from the antibiotics, and then all the toxins that you breathe in the air in a polluted city that's bankrupt in the 70s and 80s. So it's amazing that I'm even here today being able to have this conversation, feeling as good as I do now because of what I went through. But because I'm a wrestler and I have a very strong determination, once I started to really buy into this, I continued to buy into it And I continued to look for modalities that were non-allopathic, more Eastern traditional modalities. And then, so at 48, I was watching YouTube. I don't know how it happened, but Dr. Sebi came on the TV. And I started watching Dr. Sebi videos. And I'm like, what? This guy cured HIV through diet? How could that be? And then he started talking about it. And 3 weeks later, he died. And he was a very healthy man.
Right. Like many other people.
What?
Like many other people dying under suspicious circumstances.
Yes. I forgot how, but it was definitely suspicious because he was a picture of health. Right? And he didn't kill himself or anything like that. Like Arnold Errett, who wrote The Mucusless Diet Healing System. Mm-hmm. So then, as fate would have it, watching Dr. Sibby videos created the algorithm to push Dr. Morse to me. So then I resonated a little bit more with Dr. Morse because he was talking about his patients, and specifically the one man who jumped out of an airplane, hit the water at 90 miles an hour, broke every bone in his body, severed his spine, and all they did was feed him fruit and herbs for an entire year because he couldn't choose what he wanted to eat. And he got up and walked.
Wow.
He healed. Because if you clean the tissues and you feed the body the herb that it needs, the organs can regenerate because the stem cells you're born with, they never go away. All the stem cells that you have are in your body. But like Professor Errett said, the life equation is vitality equals power minus O. O is obstructions. So when you take away the obstructions, mean when you clean the lymph and you get rid of the obstructions, so instead of being on the Los Angeles 405, you're in upstate and country, and there's not that many cars on the road, so you can flow freely. But when you're overloaded with toxins, you can't, the stem cells, they can't get to the cells that need help because there's toxins in the way. And then inflammation accrues. And then from inflammation, you get named diseases by sorcerers who are Western-trained, apparently medicine doctors, right? I mean, that's what they are. They're medicine doctors. But they're sorcerers, even if they don't know it. Maybe some of them do. Probably most of them don't. But the root etymology of pharmacy is pharmakeia, and that means sorcery.
Hmm. I didn't know that.
Now, these things are not debatable because all you have to do is look at it. And they trick us with words and spells. So I started to really dive deep into this. And I'm like, if Dr. Morse is seeing all these people heal themselves on fruits, I want to try this. So my wife was like, you're going to what? You know, I was vegan. I was already vegan for like 3 years. I haven't had flesh in 13 years. I stopped at 42 because I had irritable bowel syndrome. When I farted, I could clean out an auditorium. I mean, I was stank so bad. My armpits would stink. I had night sweats every night. I couldn't sleep. I was an insomniac. Things were really bad. And as I was getting to be that age, so after I started learning from Dr. Morse, I just watched hundreds of his videos. And I was like, all right, I started learning it and learning it. But I'm not an iridologist and I'm not an herbologist. So I was going on his website and buying herbs that I thought would be good for me. And I was mixing and matching. And I think that actually hurt me because it really affected my teeth. Because if you cleanse too fast and you don't cleanse transitionally, all the toxins that come out in your body can affect your healthy cells. So for people out there, you can't just go on a fruit diet. You have to have somebody who's trained. But I went fully fruit for 6 months, and every single night I would have a raw, dehydrated vegetable wrap. And I would make my own guacamole, nothing in it, just guacamole, some herbs, and no spices, because I was trying not to get stimulated. And I was allowing myself to feel like I was eating. So for 6 months, Chad, all I had was fruit during the day. And every single night I had the same exact meal.
At the time you were seeing an acupuncturist, correct?
I'm getting to
so,
that.
Yeah. I love this part of the story.
Yeah. So 2 years prior, 2.5 years prior, I had a different acupuncturist who was brilliant. And she said to me, within 5 minutes, she listened to my pulse. She said, stick out your tongue. She said, Brian, men like you have a heart attack in your 60s and die. And I went, what? I was like, look at me. What? Look at how I look. How could you say that? I'm a picture of health. And she said, no, you're not. She said, do you sleep well? I said, no. She says, when you pee, does it burn? I said, yes. She said, when you're finished peeing, do you feel like you have to keep going? I said, yes. She said, when you go to the bathroom, is it easy for you to go to the bathroom? I said, no. I had everything she said, I was yes to. And I said, okay, there's something to this. And again, it's not like I bought into it right away because I'm learning now. I'm hearing the information. But me as a wrestler, again, I was like, well, that's not going to be me. I'm not going to have a heart attack in my 60s and die. I'm going to do what I can. So I was with her for 2.5 years, and then she said to me in the middle of a session, she listened to my pulse, I said, my hands are freezing in the winter. I can't keep them warm, my feet, my hands. And she said, she made two mistakes. Number one, she told me that I was predisposed to die, even though it worked for me. You don't tell a brainstem that right away. And she said, you have Raynaud's disease. And I said, what's that? And she said, well, it's a blood disorder. And I was like, okay, well, I haven't been to the doctor in like 8 years. Should I go to the doctor? And she said, no, because they're gonna put you on medication and that ain't gonna help you at all. It's only gonna make things worse for your liver and your kidneys. She said, your kidneys, I can't even feel the pulse of your kidneys. Your liver is shot. Your lungs are not in good shape. And I'm like, whoa, my God, I'm listening to this. And I'm like, okay, all right, keep talking. So I said to her, I can heal, right? Because I had already healed my discs. And I knew that if my discs could grow back, I could heal what she was telling me. I was already on the journey. And then she said, well, you're 48 years old. You dry out as you get older. Right, dry out, because TCM, they don't talk about being on a high fruit diet. So she's thinking, well, you dry out, they don't really look at the lymphatic system. And I'm like, but Dr. Morris, I'm like already thinking. So I said, all right, well, I need to find someone else because you don't believe I can heal. And I need somebody in my energy space that believes I can heal. So my chiropractor introduced me to Dr. Ming here in Chinatown, and I started seeing him, and he said, I agree with her assessment. And I was like, what? Even after 2.5 years of treatment? But I was still eating cooked vegan food. So I wasn't getting clean. I was only stopping maybe some of the degradation from happening. I was slowing it down. But I wasn't in any kind of regeneration. I was just slowing down the progress because now I wasn't eating meats or dairy, but I was still eating cooked food. I was still eating breads. In fact, I was probably still eating eggs, not really understanding that that was not good for me either. And so I found Dr. Morse like 3 months after I started seeing this guy. And then I told him, I said, Dr. Ming, I'm going to go on an all-fruit diet. And he said, I don't think you should do that. I said, why not? He said, because you need protein. And I'm like, but I don't eat protein. I haven't had protein in 5 years. I've been vegetarian for 5 years. I'm like, I still got muscle. And he's like, well, you know, in TCM, they're talking about the elements. And I'm like, I respect you. You've helped me a lot. He was the master at removing inflammation. So by seeing my body worker who introduced me to the chiropractor, so I'd already had like 4 years of healthy Eastern medicine people in my camp. So I said, well, Dr. Ming, I respect you, but I'm going to do it anyway. And after 4 weeks, I was going to him every week. At that point, I was able to go every week. And after 4 weeks, he said, "Wow, you're changing rapidly." He said, "This diet's working for you, and you should keep going, and I'm learning from you." And I was like, now that's the type of person that I want to have facilitating my healing, because he's facilitating it, right? He's not healing me. He's facilitating a method, and then my body heals itself. So that was 6.5 years ago. And he's now, a year into that, he said, "You know, remember I told you I didn't think you should do this diet?" He said, "But Brian, what you've done with your organs is nothing short of remarkable. I've never seen anything like it. I didn't know it could be done, and this is incredible." So I actually reversed my organ damage, specifically my kidneys. He said, "Your kidneys were in the basement. They were not functioning." But they don't really tell you these things, right? She did, but he has a different approach because he's Chinese, Qigong master. So, but I want to know these things because it motivates me. But, you know, I understand brain stems can't hear that. So I've been on that journey now for 6.5 years, and he says that I'm strengthening my primordial chi energy. He said, "I've never seen anybody do that, especially from where you've come from. I was just hoping to help you not get worse." So 6.5 years later, I'm still on the diet. Do I have cooked food? Am I fully fruitarian and raw food? No, because my wife isn't even vegan. So maybe twice a month, I go out with her and I'll have salad on the menu. It might have vinegar on it. I normally, when I make my own salads, I use lemon, lime, and orange for my dressing and herbs. So if I go out, because I know my organs are in good shape, I'm like, you know what? 1 or 2 days is not going to kill me. I don't need to label myself a raw foodist. I don't need to label myself a fruitarian. What I want to do is not even think about the future. I want to live in the present moment, and I want to take right actions, and I'm going to take as many right actions as I can. And sometimes if I have a vegetable that's cooked, yes, it's a step down, but it ain't doing anything to me. So if I live to 100 and not 105, I'm okay with that. I'm totally okay with that. But I stopped drinking coffee 8 years ago. I stopped drinking alcohol 8 years ago. I'm sure you've heard me talk on podcasts. I was drug-free my whole life until 29. That's when my life really fell apart. I let the demons in. I did a lot of recreational drugs in the 90s here in New York City. I destroyed my nose. But your body can repair all of it. And I'm about to be 56. I'm moving as well as I ever did when I was 20. My breathing is great. My acupuncturist, my chiropractor, you know, they're still healing to go. It never ends. But they're like, "You're going to live a long and healthy life." So, Chad, that's my long-winded intro. I hope the listeners did not get bored listening to me talk for nearly, oh my gosh, that was nearly 30 minutes. I'm sorry. But, you know, it rolls off my tongue, man. I just have this ability now to say it, I think, in a very cohesive way, too, to help everybody understand how the journey is and what you need to do in order to, you know, make all roads meet to one, right? So you take body work, you take acupuncture, you take chiropractic, you take raw foods, and you merge every single day. You try to take right action, so you're always going straight, and then maybe you veer a little bit, right? But me veering is cooked food. That's like the worst that happens now in my life, is that I might have cooked food every once in a while, or vinegar and oil on a salad. Mm-hmm. So I'm okay with that.
Yeah, that's it's a remarkable story, and I think people really connect to other people's stories. Like, if it's possible for one person, it's possible for everyone, right? And rarely is the path of healing ever linear. You don't really understand where you're going when you're going through it. You just need to trust, and like you said, let all the roads really converge as you bring together everything you've learned and experienced. And so I really love your story. There's so many parallels as an athlete myself, as a lifelong athlete. But I want to touch a little bit more upon the diet. You talked about the transition and how you need to be responsible. You can't go onto this sort of thing too fast because of the cleansing reactions that you'll see. And this is when people fail on these types of diets. But I think the idea of using fruit to cleanse the body and regenerate is a very shocking concept for a lot of people. So can you kind of just lay that out real quick? Why fruits, and build us a case for what you call a species-specific diet?
Yeah, well, if we go back millions of years ago, because humans have been around millions of years, and I'm sorry for people who believe in the book, because they say we've only been here for 6,000 years. Civilization has been cycling itself, according to the Vedas, for a really long time.
Yeah.
Right? There's always been some form of human here on the planet. And if the evolution theory of tectonic plate movements is correct, we were one continent at one time, and it was tropical. And we were living in harmony with the earth and animals even. And the first form of consciousness was probably flowers. You know, everything was plants and grasses, and then flower came. And the flower is like, excuse me for this word, but like the ejaculation of a plant, that the consciousness of the plant gets so high, it makes a flower. And then from one flower come millions of flowers. And then from flowers, you're going to get trees that grow bright, vibrant, fibrous fruits that have structured water in them. And that water inside the fruit is been electrolyzed by the sun. It's got phytonutrients in it, and it doesn't require insulin when it's consumed. So that means you digest it like that. It goes right through you. And if there's any toxins in the system, fruit is astringent. Because it doesn't require insulin, that means that when it goes through you, it pulls with it anything that doesn't belong inside the lymphatic system, and then the stem cells can do their job by committing apoptosis for other cells. So like, there wasn't fruit everywhere. We would have to walk miles and miles and miles. And this is where intermittent fasting comes in, fasting itself, because we would find an orchard, and it would just be one orchard. There wouldn't be blueberries, strawberries, and raspberries. There would be miles of blueberries. And then the hominid would gorge himself, or herself, whatever, on all these blueberries, and then they would meander. They would meander somewhere else, just walking the earth with their feet on the ground, being fully connected, maybe hearing messages from the earth, right? Because they were fully connected, like the indigenous tribes who could speak and hear the messages that earth was giving to them. That's how they knew to do ayahuasca. How would you know to do a vine unless you got communication? So then you'd have to walk. Maybe you didn't eat for a day or two. So during that time, your body would have to go into ketosis to keep you alive. So it would then run on the fat in your body, but that's an emergency system. That's not a system you want to live in. It's a system that your body developed because the next orchard might not be for a day or two. And then you might come up on a banana orchard. And then you'd have to bite into these things. And you had really strong teeth, like Weston Price talked about, of the African tribes, with their really wide jaws and their ability to breathe. And, you know, but they lived to 100. 100 is not very long, because they were meat eaters. So they were not eating their species-specific diet. They had already succumbed to killing food and sentient beings. But back then on Pangaea, we were eating the fruit, consuming the seeds, and then we would poop the seeds out, and then the orchard could grow somewhere else. Do you know the book Return to the Brain of Eden?
Yes, I read it.
By Tony Wright?
Yep, I think I heard your recommendation, and I read that. I read Man's Higher Consciousness, kind of, yeah. Fascinating.
The three most important books in my life are Return to the Brain of Eden by Tony Wright, Man's Higher Consciousness by Professor Hilton Hotima, and The Mucusless Diet Healing System by Professor Arnold Eric.
Absolutely.
And if you learn those three books, then you will be on the right path. Mm-hmm. So, we already had the big brain. That's what they don't get. Science wants to tell you that we developed a big brain by eating meat. But if you go on Google Scholar and you type in brain size, you'll see that the human brain has shrunk over the last 10,000 years. And when did society start? Somewhere in Turkey around 10,000 years ago, we started creating camps. And then we started growing wheat that was not indigenous. And we started putting foods in our body that created mucus and stagnation. And then we started living shorter lives. And then all of a sudden we started killing our food. And our brains have gotten smaller. So anytime you see a study that says your brain got, you learned to make fire, well, you had to learn to make fire before you learned to kill. And the reason you were able to do that is because fruit is the perfect neurochemistry for the brain, because that's the way Earth designed it. It was designed to be eaten, to fall to the ground, to have the animals and the hominids to eat it, to proliferate itself around the Earth, and then you wouldn't be aggressive. In fact, most of your free testosterone would be bound. And if your free testosterone is bound, you're going to be in more harmony. And I used to be very aggressive. I was a very aggressive person. I wrestled and I ate rotted, desiccated meat, and it made me aggressive. And then I was stimulated all the time from these meats. And stimulation means you're going to do stimulating things, or you're going to act in a stimulating way. And I believe that that's not what was happening. We evolved, or forget even evolution, we adapted on fruit. And then when the continent started to slide and drift, and some of us got pushed into higher climates, we had to eat whatever the hell we could. And then we started to eat other things. So that's where that came in. And if you watch Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, you're kind of young. Have you ever seen 2001 A Space Odyssey?
I have.
In the beginning of the movie, I don't want to ruin it for people, but in the beginning of the movie, they show you that the animals lived in harmony. And then something happened. Something appeared. And the animals touched it. And the next time they came to the watering hole, they came with a club. And they started killing each other. So we've been manipulated on a level that we're unaware of to be not nice, I want to call it.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. And I would even go so far as to say that we were originally designed to eat fruit, because I think the biggest tell with that is you can look at any species' anatomy and physiology and you can tell exactly what they're going to eat, and no species is as confused as human beings about what they should eat. Lions eat what lions eat, birds eat what birds eat. It's just us who have kind of lost our way. And I think if you look at something like the fruitarian chart or the frugivore chart, so that kind of compares all the different anatomies between herbivores, omnivores, carnivores, you can't really make an argument that we were designed to eat meat. So I think you would probably agree on that. Now, most people who are familiar with this type of diet are familiar with the concept of alkaline versus acid-forming foods. You talked about it briefly, but it's the acid byproducts that really harm the body, and it starts to wreak havoc and manifest in disease and stagnation. But a question I've always kind of had is, when we say foods are acid forming, what's actually happening? Because I understand that the body will do everything it can to keep the blood
RNA.
pH, RNA,
nucleic acids.
So So it's more at the cellular or interstitial levels, not so much the blood, because the blood is maintaining around like a 7.4 pH. Can you explain what's happening with the acids at more of a cellular level?
Yeah, well, if you're putting in more acids than your body can clear, then those acids are lowering the interstitial pH. But it doesn't affect blood pH. It can, but breathing is what affects blood pH, not food. And I just want to back up a little. I actually very kindly disagree with you. We were not designed to eat fruit. We were designed to breathe.
I didn't want to talk about that. Yeah.
We were not. We adapted once we finally, whatever hominid finally started to drink something or eat something, the organs of digestion created themselves. That was the adaptation. They put stuff in their body because we were light beings. We were living on a high vibrational planet during the Vedas, the Vesica Pisces, where we're in the middle of the photon belt. We were in the, you know, the golden age.
Yeah, very advanced civilizations.
Yeah. Yeah, but yes, Lemuria, not Atlantis, Lemuria. Mm-hmm. And we didn't even speak. We communicated through consciousness. I knew everything about you. You knew everything about me. I didn't have to talk to you. You knew what I was going to say, and we could communicate through telepathy. So at some point, we finally took a drink, and then we finally ate something. And when we ate something, we ate a fruit. In the lost books of Eden, it says that when they left the garden, and the garden wasn't a place, it was the garden of breathing. When they left that garden and they finally took that tree of knowledge, that bite, they started to get stimulated. So even fruit is very slightly stimulating. It does create, Dr. Morse tells you this, it does create a little bit of mucus, but very, very little. So if you eat fruit your whole life, you're still going to wind up dying. But if you do a technique like kaya kalpa in the ancient Vedic teachings that Babaji has done, you can live forever. And in India, they know of Babaji. Babaji is actually in India considered the God, the all-knowing consciousness, supreme consciousness. And he's been coming to people for over 2,000 years, and he's never eaten or drank. And in India, they're called sannyasi. And I don't know if there's a lot, but there are people who live in the mountains, and I'm sure in China too. That's why the Chinese went into the mountains and tried to kill all the indigenous kung fu masters. We were breatharian. We are breatharian in nature. And then we adapted to eat fruit, and then we were reared for millions of years on fruit. So by being so long on fruit, it makes us look as if we're a frugivore. So we will function best as a frugivore. Now, I'm nowhere near breatharian. I am still addicted to eating. I'm also, my eyes are not blue. So there's still a relative, there's stagnation in my body. I still need to be cleaner. When my eyes are blue, I'll probably be very, very clean, and I might live to 150, 200. Again, that's not my goal. My goal is to be happy and now. But just wanted to touch on that for you, because when you eat proteins, you're eating RNA, and that's going to break down as ribonucleic acids. And it's those acids that get stuck in the porous fascial tissue, which is your lymph. So the interstitium, which only became an organ in 2017, is your lymphatic system. So when the cell poops, it poops into the interstitium, but it also brings food in. And this is, what a great segue. So it brings food in from the interstitium. That's why I'm on marine phytoplankton, which Magdalena doesn't believe in, because Dr. Morse doesn't. Noah doesn't talk about it. And she's like, it's acids because it's amino acids. I'm like, no. The phytoplankton was the first organism ever conscious on the planet, and it was a microscopic organism in the ocean. And however it came to be, which is through Rupert Sheldrake's morphic resonance, it created itself through light, sound, and vibration, which is cymatics. So somehow the energy brought this organism together. And when it brought it together, it had all the building blocks of life, all the essential amino acids. Now, amino acids aren't acids. They're essential that our body needs. They're not ribonucleic acids. It had all of the essential fats, all of the minerals, and almost all of the vitamins. So I have been on marine phytoplankton for 9 years, and I get it from a company called AscendedHealth.com, and it's expensive because they use scalar wave technology. So for people out there who can't afford that brand, you can go to PlanktonHolland.com, and you can get exactly the same phytoplankton, but it just doesn't have the technology that Ascended Health uses in their products, because they're actually using science now to make things even more effective. So from phytoplankton came everything else on Earth. And then the plants were able to grow. I'm not really sure how we got here. I'm not really sure if we were seeded by intelligent beings or we came from the ocean. I don't really know. It's one of those two ways. One of those two ways. Maybe we were here already, and when they showed up, they started altering our DNA.
That's kind of what I believe.
Make us workers.
Right.
You know?
And you can go back to the Sumerian text for that.
Right. That's where Stanley Kubrick comes in at the beginning scene. Right? So that's kind of how I believe. So I believe that taking the phytoplankton is best for me when I'm eating this fruit diet, because I know I'm getting everything I need, because the nitrogen in the soil is depleted. And that's really important. And phytoplankton is loaded with nitrogen. It's got chlorophyll in it. It's got everything you need in it. So the fruit I'm eating might not be as healthy as I think it is, because I don't know where it's being grown. And you could say it's organic, but if there's planes flying over that organic field that are spraying aluminum, barium, and strontium, it's no longer organic.
Exactly.
So it doesn't matter whether you eat conventional or you eat organic, because even the organic is still conventional now. Mm-hmm. But these things are going to change, because we are moving into a new earth and nothing can stop what's coming.
Yeah, absolutely. And very important point with the breatharianism too. Thank you for bringing that up. But to go back to the acids in the lymphatic system, is that where the stimulation comes from when you eat high protein foods? Is that where you're getting that nerve stimulation in the interstitial space?
Yes.
So when you're eating a lot of acids, I would imagine your lymph is extremely acidic, and that acid is kind of binding to the nerves. Is that accurate?
Yes. It basically it's like snow that gets impacted and becomes ice. So it compresses the nerves, and then you're going to eat a bug. That bug is going to live inside your body, and it's going to live on those acids that press on the nerves, because parasites are very attracted to nerves. I was going to say something right before that. But anyway, yes. Oh, the pH. So the interstitial pH should be of a more alkaline variety. But when we say alkaline, we're talking about this much. Your blood pH neutral is 7.365. And alkaline is 7.465, which is very, very minuscule. Very minuscule. It's just a little. Now, I've worked with people, Chad, who are very overweight, and I've taught them to actually be able to breathe better and create a stronger nervous system without even being on a raw diet. Because some people don't want to do it. They're like, I know what you do. I'm really just interested in how you work with the nervous system. I don't want to follow that diet. And I'm like, okay. So I've seen people heal themselves on non-raw diets, But of course, I think they would be better served if they did have a raw diet perspective. But breathing will change the pH of your blood in real time, whereas the fruit and the herbs take a long time. And when that happens, and these things come out in your body, you could have very big crises. And I had a crisis recently in March that really hampered me really, really badly. I had a healing crisis from being on herbs. And it wasn't anybody's fault. It was what was unlocked inside my body that really did a number on me. And I've been recovering ever since, actually.
Very interesting. And that would make total sense why people have such a hard time getting off of acid-forming foods and why people say they feel better after they eat something that's high in protein like meat. And you can't really blame people, because when our bodies are that acidic on the inside, we're going to crave those acid foods coming in from the outside so we can get that continued hit of stimulation. I think this is a great transition into the breathing aspect. We've talked about the acidity that you experience with diet. Is that related to the acidity in the blood that ties into CO2 and oxygen, or are eating and breathing completely different things?
They're completely different things. Because I have a friend who's been fruitarian for most of her life, 38 years, and she was not breathing well when we started working together. And her nervous system needed help too. So no, just being on a raw food diet is not going to change your sensory cortex. You have to actually stimulate your cranial nerves, because we've all experienced trauma, emotional and physical. And when you experience trauma, I want you to think of yourself as a house. And every house has a grounding rod, a lightning rod, and then it grounds the energy into the earth. Your circuit might blow, your lights might go out, but the lights go out so the house doesn't fry, so it doesn't go on fire. We are exactly the same way. So if I get punched in the face, I'm going to have my, you know, you're going to see that bright light. I'm going to have an explosion. My circuit's going to fry. The circuit's going to go in my brain, but nobody knows how to turn it back on. So you could be raw all you want, but that will never turn your cranial nerves back on. And I can say this comfortably because my friend who's been fruitarian most of her life still needs help. So the diet didn't improve her nervous system at that level. But yet, she's been to my acupuncturist and her organs are in great shape. But again, there's always room to expand.
Yeah, and that's kind of your message too, is you can't have things in isolation. It's all important that it all converges into one big picture.
Right, the roads, exactly.
Yeah.
So I send all my students to an iridologist. I tell them, I try to get them eating raw. I work on their brain. I work on their breathing. And then that's it, because the raw diet. So in 100 years ago, they would call this nerve the pneumogastric nerve. Today we call it the vagus nerve. But the most amount of neurons in your body or in your gut double than what's in your head. So it really matters what you ingest on a daily basis, which is why I stopped drinking anything that doesn't serve me. Even teas. I've been hooked on teas. Even Dr. Morse. Dr. Morse had kidney stones not that long ago. And he said, I drink tea every single day because I'm working and I want to drink tea. And the tannins in the tea probably collected and he got a stone. Because tea is sort of unnatural. Like the Chinese masters, they're going to drink one tiny cup, a shot glass of tea every day. Me, this is actually coconut water, but I would drink two of these of tea every day. And then I was putting honey in it. And then I said, oh my God, honey's ribonucleic acids too. So then I had to start eliminating the honey. No more plant milks, unless you can find something that you can make yourself. There's got to be at least one preservative in the plant milk, and it's usually some form of citric acid, something acid. So you're slowing down your process of healing because you're continuing to feed the acidity that's in your body. And the reason you're doing it isn't because you go, but it's my ritual. I love having coffee. I love having milk and honey. No, it's the bugs that are living inside of you that want that acidity, and they emit frequencies which keep you hooked on the things that you think you love. You know, I have friends that are really heavy drinkers, and they think they can get away with it because they can still navigate life, some of them pretty successful. That is until you can't.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And like we talked about earlier, I think the human body can easily live to 150.
Yeah.
Easily. So people will think, so I might live to 75, but I live my life the way I wanted. Well, yeah, yes. That's okay. As long as you feel that that's what you want to do, there's also a degree of non-stress about it. You know, I have a friend like that, and I actually applaud the fact that he feels so good, and that's who he wants to be, and I think that it helps him live a healthier life, so to speak, because he's doing it with grace, so to speak. Yeah, he's polluting his body, but he does it with a state of grace. That's pretty cool. But your body will give out in a moment's notice. It won't be slow. It'll be all of a sudden.
Yeah, and I think what we kind of have to take into consideration too is everybody's soul is here for a different adventure. And some people, you know, they decided, I want to be here to have a good time and I don't really care about longevity and health. And that's all good, no judgment there. But I think individuals like you and myself are really interested in, like, what's possible for the human species? How much of our potential can we really unlock?
Right.
So what I was hoping we could do right now is have you walk me and the audience through what it actually feels like to take a proper breath and get that cadence and see what it's like in the body to be in that fully relaxed nervous system state. So would you be able to take us through that? And then afterwards, we'll talk about kind of what's actually happening in the biochemistry with the CO2 and the acidity and the oxygen.
Yeah, very beautiful. So we're going to take our hands and we're going to put them on our rib cage right here. So not on the ribs, just under the rib cage. So you're going to have your hands here. And if your shoulders get tired, you could put your arms down. But I'm going to show dimension number one, which is breathing light, which is biochemical breathing. And then I'm going to also incorporate dimension number two, which is diaphragmatic breathing. So it's nice to have the hands on the rib cage so you can feel yourself breathing. So you can keep your eyes open or closed. Closed is probably better because now you're in your interoceptive sense, which is the sixth sense. And right now, all I want you to do is observe how you breathe. You've watched me, my videos, you've watched many other people. Don't think about where you're breathing. Let it happen on its own. Step outside your body and watch the body breathe as naturally as it can, because that's your truest state. So just observe how you breathe. Don't judge it. Don't control it. Because you don't breathe the air. The air breathes for you. And that's breatharianism, Chad. Mm. Think about that. If we were in our natural state, we would be breathing so perfectly that we would literally attain Buddhahood. That's what it's about. And so, as you sit there and observe your breathing, I want you to put all your attention onto your nostrils. And most people think the nostrils point down, but you have to breathe in horizontally into the back of your throat. So we don't breathe up, we breathe horizontally into the back of the throat. And as we breathe horizontally, we want to feel the air entering the nose as gentle as we can. So just nice and light. So if you can hear yourself breathing, try to soften the breathing so you don't hear any sounds. If you can feel yourself breathing in your nose, try to make your breathing so light that the fine nose hairs do not even move as you breathe in. If you can feel yourself breathing, as you inhale, try not to feel any turbulence in the back of your nose. Try not to feel yourself breathing. Breathing is autonomic and it happens naturally. And when the brain is safe, breathing is restored. So as you breathe in horizontally, you're going to notice that when the breath hits the back of your throat, it's like a simultaneous feeling. You're going to inhale into your anus. When you inhale as low as you can, which is your south pole, your diaphragm is going to move down. When you breathe light, you change the chemistry of your blood to a more alkaline state because carbon dioxide is starting to increase a little bit. Because when we ask the person to breathe slower and lower and gentler, they're used to breathing harder, they start to retain carbon dioxide. And that's called the oxygen hemoglobin disassociation curve. So when you start to feel a slight want or hunger for air, because you're breathing so lightly, it signifies that you're doing the exercise correctly and you're bringing your blood pH back to neutral. Because as carbon dioxide increases in your blood, it signals hemoglobin to disassociate from the oxygen molecule that it's been carrying. When you breathe in, oxygen gets absorbed by the cell. It's when you breathe out that it gets delivered. So if we breathe in light and we retain more carbon dioxide at the end of our breath, we liberate and utilize and optimize more oxygen. So feel the slightly colder air enter your nose and feel the slightly warmer air leave your nose. Now that you can feel the difference in the temperature of the air, I invite you to initiate your inhale from behind your nostrils. Don't even feel the air moving through them. Initiate the inhale from inside your nostrils, because all you're doing is exchanging pressure with the atmosphere. The air is already in your nose. You're not pulling it through, it's already in there. So if you initiate the inhale from inside your nose, you're going to breathe so slow, so gentle, and so light that you're going to create turbulence inside your nose. And your paranasal sinuses are going to secrete the miracle gas, nitric oxide. And the nitric oxide, as the oxygen's being discombobulated and humidified inside the sinuses and the turbinates, the nitric oxide is going to combine with the oxygen molecule, and you're going to bring more oxygen deeper into the lower parts of your lungs than you ever have before. So breathe so light that the fine nose hairs in your nostrils barely move. However, if you feel any feelings of discomfort coming on, before you have the actual feeling of discomfort, you should breathe in more air. Never push through this exercise. You'll know if you're breathing so light that you're starting to feel discomforting. And as soon as that feeling happens, stop the exercise, or you could throw people into a panic attack. So we want the breathing to be as light and gentle and comfortable as possible. We don't want to feel suffocated. We don't want to feel very challenged. We just want to feel as if we're breathing effortlessly. When you're ready, you can come back into the space, back into your body, and tell the listeners your experience.
Wow, thank you. That was incredible. I feel, trying to describe how I feel, I think the best way I could describe it is like a simultaneous relaxation and energy, both at the same time. It's like this mental clarity where it's not like a stimulated energy. It's coming from like deep within, if that makes sense.
Yes, because you're stimulating your energy body. Oxygen carries a positive electron. So you are getting stimulated when you breathe in. That's why you have electricity to beat your heart. But that would be as little stimulation as Earth provided for us. Would be just a stimulation of inhaling oxygen is enough to keep us alive. And that's in Man's Higher Consciousness by Hilton Hotima. And he gives you the science of the energy that supports the body to, if you want to say, feed itself. I actually can't explain that. I don't have that vernacular down to explain it. I can't explain breatharianism, but it's in Hilton Hotima's book, but I haven't memorized it. But what we did with that exercise, which is what you were asking probably for your listeners, because Wim Hof is very popular. Holotropic breathing is very popular. This vitality breathing is very popular. There's a large growing number of breathing instructors now, just like yoga instructors in the 80s and 90s. Now everybody's becoming a breathing instructor, but they're doing hyperventilation techniques. I'm actually teaching people how to restore their innate ability to breathe, which the yogic science of breath is to be a complete breather, which means your breath cleanses your interstitial space and feeds your cells. Now, what we put in our body interferes with that process. So that's where that comes in. When I ask you to breathe light, it's the carbon dioxide through the Bohr effect that liberates oxygen. And then that oxygen went to your prefrontal cortex and it created the parasympathetic effect. And then you're stimulating your glossopharyngeal nerve, which is your regulator, your pressure regulator, and that deals with your blood gases. So what creates biochemistry in the oxygen advantage in Buteyko is the strength of cranial nerve number 9, because it's our pressure regulator nerve. So on the energetic level, you have to have that nerve functioning at capacity for the rest of the body to work well, because that's determining your blood gases. So you can clean yourself through breathing alone, but of course most of us are way too dense. We would have to do a lot of cleaning to get to any kind of that level, right?
Right.
So that's where, and then the biomechanics I didn't get into with you, but if you breathe light, your phrenic nerve senses safety, and it allows the intercostal muscles to open, to contract, but very gently. And then the rib cage opens gently. So they say, some people will teach pranayama, breathe into your belly, breathe into your thorax, and then into your clavicular. But that's not the right way to teach it. It's that you breathe down, and when you breathe down, everything segment from the bottom to the top starts to get wider. So the bottom segment moves first, then the above that, then above that. So that's when it looks like I'm bringing the breath, because people will try to do that with their lungs. They'll breathe in and they'll fill their lungs to get to that top. But what I'm saying as a restorative breathing coach is that the slower you breathe in, the more nitric oxide you produce, the more carbon dioxide you retain. Both of those are endogenous gases that create vasodilation. So we can create expansion without having to breathe in more air. And we actually absorb more oxygen because of the nitric oxide. And then we won't have diseases like autoimmune diseases and heart disease and all that stuff, because it really is a breathing problem. Everybody has a breathing problem. I've worked with over 1,000 people, and I would say, well, I know I've only met two good breathers. And then maybe 99.5% of them are breathing actually poorly, because the world around us is taking you out of your harmony and you don't know it. So now everybody goes, no, this is great. We have social media. We have texting. Oh my God. It's just keeping you constantly stimulated. And I'm a part of it, because this is what I do for a living. So I'm a part of that, but I do also spend time alone, and I don't even call it meditation. I call it breathing. Mm-hmm. Like in Autobiography of a Yogi, Yogananda would go over to Lahiri Maheshai, and that was, they considered him, the Indians had a lot of saints, but Yogananda's guru was supposed to be as close to the Buddha as possible. And that's who Yogananda, you know, got trained by. And he would walk up to him, he'd be sitting still, and they would look at him, and they would say, he's not breathing. So I can explain this to you. It makes sense to me. So when he wasn't breathing, he was fully exhaled. The exhale doesn't mean empty lungs. It means, because the lungs should never fully empty, there should always be a degree of elasticity left. So he would breathe out, and the reason he stopped breathing was because his tolerance to CO2 was through the roof, because his cranial nerves were connected to the source. And he was a power generator, so his CO2 levels didn't increase. So he was regulating pressure, so his blood gases would stay like this, and his blood pH was probably at the perfect level. And then when he needed to breathe, it's because it went from here to here. Because his breath wouldn't be, it would be like I was trying to teach you. That next breath would be, remember, he's in meditation. The next breath would be almost unintelligible to the human eye. And then they would breathe out again and not breathe in again. That's the Bohr effect. That's what we're trying to achieve with light breathing, with breath holding. We're trying to achieve a state that when you're at rest, even if you live in New York City, when you breathe out, you should not need to breathe in again for a certain amount of time. But almost everybody is in and out, in and out, in and out. That is stimulation. And that's what allows or disallows you from seeing the truth of who you truly are.
Yeah, it's the opposite of what we've all been told pretty much with breathing, that as you described, it's the CO2. And if I remember the Bohr effect, it's the relationship between acidity, CO2, and oxygen. Is that correct? So when we're increasing, if we're increasing our tolerance to CO2, and that CO2 reacts to form carbonic acid, if I remember right, isn't that driving the acidity up and the pH down? Is that counterproductive to what we want? Or is it over time we're rebalancing the internal environment of the body?
Yeah. Are you speaking at it from a breathing perspective or holding breath holding?
Is it different?
Yeah, because in breath holding, we're causing that to happen. We want to acidify the blood, because when carbon dioxide goes up and oxygen goes down, they release hydrogen ions into the blood. And that's what acidifies the blood. So the blood is becoming more acidic, but it's an endogenous response, an innate response of the body due to diving. So we naturally have adapted that as that blood acidity is increasing, our body is actually buffering acid by making pyruvate and water. It's actually creating water, and it's learning how to buffer the acid as it rises. So Lahiri Maheshai wasn't having any of that response in his body. His body was perfectly regulated. What's happening for us is that as the ions go up and down, the breath hold starts to come on because you're increasing your lactate. But the longer you can hold your breath, the higher lactate threshold you'll have. And when you have a higher lactate threshold, your blood pH is more neutral. It fosters and enables you to breathe slow all the time. It feeds back into you being able to breathe slow because it strengthens your diaphragm when you hold your breath. Your breath recoils, but you don't have to struggle to do it. You just have to do challenge. You work up to a challenge of a breath hold, but of course you need to be guided, right? So it's never trying to hold my breath for as long as I can, set records. It's always to the point where you're like, that's enough. Now I'm going to let go and I'm going to recover my breathing back to normal as fast as I can. And I teach athletes this. And I have a swimmer right now. He's getting ready for the World Championships in Singapore. And he's a former world champ, I believe, in the short course in 2022. And he has not really touched those times since then, because he's been training like an animal. Because as you get better, you train harder. And that has actually corrupted his breathing. And he told me that when they were getting ready to do intervals in practice, he would get nauseous. So he would get nauseous because he was already over-breathing for practice, because nobody taught him how to breathe. So his breathing was already not great. You would say, what? He's an Olympic, a world champ. But when you go through the assessments of how they breathe, you go, wow, people can actually be Olympians and still be breathing bad.
Yeah.
Like, that's when I go, holy shit, wow. I'm like, I get a lot of Olympians, and I'm like, well, he's really not breathing very well. So you can still navigate and still be a world champion. You know, that's why anybody can be taught how to breathe better. It doesn't matter how poor your breathing is, because even the best of the best are poorly breathing. So now he can hold his breath for 3 minutes.
Wow.
And when you can hold your breath for 3 minutes without feeling, because lactate's rising, so that's stress. You're adapting to the buildup of acidity, which is stress, but it's called a hormetic stress. So it's progressive. So each time, it's like, unfortunately, the analogy I have is because I live in New York, it's like getting a heroin addict off of heroin and giving them methadone, but in the opposite reverse. So each time I'm giving myself a stimulant of being stimulated from holding my breath, but I'm not challenging it to the point of killing myself. So I can actually use that stress, that stimulated stress, as a really progressive thing that can make me feel all day long happy and have mental cognition and be mentally acute in the moment. Like, I don't want to get high on my own supply. I want to teach people how to live high through their supply.
Yeah, I see. So the acidity, you're only going to see a rise during something like a breath hold, but doing those breath holds is kind of increasing that threshold and helping us adapt so our normal breathing patterns change. And through normal breathing, light and slow, that's where you're going to see the internal environment of the body really change over the long term. Okay, I
Bingo.
See.
That was beautiful what you just said.
Got it.
That's the plan.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to create the body's environment to self-heal because it knows already what to do.
Makes total sense. And I did want to ask you about what you brought up earlier with things like Wim Hof and holotropic. I think everybody in breath work is familiar with these. Can you explain kind of what's happening in the body when you do something with a hyperventilation, when you're exhaling CO2 very strongly?
Yeah. Well, on an energetic level, you're losing ions. That's to make it very simple, and there's science behind it. So you're losing ions, you're losing energy, because you're removing the precious gas, carbon dioxide. So when you do a hyperventilation technique and you off gas, you lower CO2, and then the oxygen stays bound to hemoglobin inside the red blood cell. So I'm hyperventilating and I'm starting to have an ethereal experience, but at the cellular level and at the energetic level, I'm actually hurting myself. I have to then try to heal from that. Right? I have to heal from that because it's not natural. It's not the natural state of the body, and people are profaning the mysteries of breathing by adding in those things. And I'll actually give the information from The Inner Bliss of Fire by Lama Yeshe. And he said monks have to be initiated for 2 to 3 years before ever learning the hyperventilation technique. So that means you have to be a master breather. And if you're a master breather and you're a complete breather, when you hyperventilate, then you know how to change the acidity of your body. You know how to change your brainwave states, and you can use it as a tool. But it's not to get high. It's to have an experience of the truth. Right? But people, they get addicted to the stimulation of the breathing. So as the ions drop and the carbon dioxide lowers, you're not getting any more oxygen to your brain. So the way I do breath holding is on the passive exhale without any, like they do 30 hyperventilation breaths in Wim Hof. We don't have to do any of that. All we have to do is go breathe out and stop your breath. That's all we have to do, right? So we don't lose any CO2. So you can get high on your own supply. That's what he's talking about. And you can get stimulated, but then you're a seeker. And you're not going to have it internally because you can't recover from the carbon dioxide loss. Every time you do a hyperventilation breath in Wim Hof, you hyperventilate for 30, you hold your breath either in or out. I think now they're doing it out, but they used to do it in when I started 8 years ago. And then your carbon dioxide is going up. So now afterwards you let go, you do another 30 hyperventilation breaths, but you never recovered the carbon dioxide you lost from the first set of hyperventilations. Because hyperventilating prior to the actual holding of the breath removes so much CO2 that when you hold your breath, they think, well, the longer I can hold my breath, the more CO2 goes up, the more I'm recovering. But no, you lost it at the base level. So the breath hold itself can't recover itself. And then every time you hyperventilate, your CO2 levels go down, down, down. And that's your end-tidal CO2. And that is for life. So when you breathe out passively, the most important blood marker is ETCO2, end-tidal CO2. And you can't measure it. You need to be on a machine. You need to know how much carbon dioxide is left in your blood at the end of a passive exhale. And I'll give you a little, when I started my Lois Laney restorative breathing program, which has catapulted me in my ideas now of breathing. As an Oxygen Advantage Master Instructor, I thought I knew it all. And then I learned brainstem breathing from Lois, who's a god in the neurology world. She's been doing this for 40 years, and she's got her method. And her method is all based on intuition and creating a parasympathetic environment of safety, because the brain can only transition from a place of safety. And when you hyperventilate, you're not feeling safe because the oxygen is bound to the hemoglobin, and your body's actually going through stress. Not in a good way either. It's a lot of a drain. It's not a hormetic adaptation. It's lowering. It's going in the opposite direction of what a hormesis would be. That's why people's hands freeze up. There's no more oxygen left, right? And some people do have out-of-body whatever, but you're not supposed to adrenalize yourself and stimulate. You're actually losing vital energy that you're not going to get back.
That's super fascinating, but it makes total sense. Now, I want to wrap up our conversation today because you got to get going here, but I want to really drive home the larger motivation, because when you do things like return to a species-specific diet, when you dial in your breath and your recovery and your sleep and your movement, you're really purifying yourself on all levels of your being, body, mind, emotion, spirit. It's a holistic journey, and I think the most common thing I hear with people on this journey is things like, I'm less moody, less angry, less judgmental. I just feel more loving and compassionate and connected to God and nature. And so to close off here, I'd love to hear just what you've experienced spiritually, emotionally, and where you see the human species headed.
Wow. Well, I grew up most of my life not believing in God because I just felt let down.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, I grew up Catholic with a grandma who's Jewish, you know, and the Jews would say, oh, you're Jewish, but the Catholics, and I think even the Bible says you are where your father is. What's the difference? Because I'm not Jewish and I'm not Italian Catholic. I'm a human being and I have connection to everybody on the earth. So there's no my people. There's all of my people, you know? So from that perspective, I try to look at it from, I've done entheogens. I've done Bufo alvarius. And I don't know if you know what that is, but.
I'm not really familiar with it, no.
Okay, so I've done an entheogen and it's called 5-MeO-DMT. It's Bufo alvarius.
Oh, so DMT.
Yeah, but DMT from the Sonoran Desert toad frog, that his sweat glands, they can scrape the venom off the sweat glands, and then they crystallize it in the sun. And then when the human, you vape it. And when I tell you that you experience God in all its totality, I kid you not. It was the most... You can't describe it in words. But what happens is you have an ego death. And they know this. This is even on 60 Minutes. They said that DMT shuts down neurons called, they label them the ego neurons. So when the left side of the brain goes to sleep, the right side wakes up, and that's your God brain. And that's what he talked about in Return to the Brain of Eden, right? We're giving the body in through food now, right? So I'm switching from the entheogens. We're giving that body that high vibrational food that is talking to the right brain. So that's why it's returned to the Brain of Eden. And then when you're on this substance, when your right brain shuts down, you release energetic blockages. You can release entities that are attached to you because you immediately become the vibrating soul you are. You immediately get connected to the energy of the universe. And that's why people say, oh, it's God, but God is just pure divine, what I felt, loving energy.
And yeah,
it was
you.
Tantric energy. I felt a little bit turned on by it, but not that kind of turned on. I was like, I was experiencing this. I was like, oh my God, I'm experiencing real tantra. I could feel it, and it was overwhelming. It was so loving and so crazy. But I also went through part of the ego death where I released a lot of emotions. And I had this energetic vomiting, like people in ayahuasca vomit. I had an energetic vomiting. I sat there and my spine was winding. And I was going, and I was purifying my soul of the matrix, of all the lives. Oh my God, I'm going to cry. Of all the lives that I've lived that did really bad things, mm-hmm. that took left brain, left action actions. Like the Buddha will call it, there's just right action. There's no right or wrong. If you have that experience of always making the right decision that never harms anybody or never contributes to suffering, then that's who you want to be, and that's how you become awakened. The Buddha never said anything about God. Never. So when I was on this experience, it taught me a lot about breathing and nervous system, but I also came back to a body that still needs healing. It didn't purify me in the way, but it showed me other aspects of reality. And when my eyes opened, I could see the hologram. You would have been, not even like now, you would have been more beautiful and more vibrant, because I would see nothing but the purest energy behind you, because they're not shamans. There's a psychologist here in New York where he travels a lot. So he's been a psychologist his whole life and he administers this. So I felt supported by somebody who's protecting me from getting up or doing something crazy, so they can protect you, but they keep the space. And when I opened my eyes, I saw the hologram of the universe. And I was like this. I said, John, what the fuck is happening? What the fuck is happening? And he said, try to calm down. Try to calm down. And they normally don't say anything, but I was overwhelmed. Forget about mushrooms. I was overwhelmed at what I was experiencing. And then in another journey I did, I became Buddha. But not that Brian Mirabella is going to all of a sudden one day become the Buddha. No, I attained Buddhahood. I felt in my psyche when I came back that I had been the Buddha. I had the experience of being the Buddha. And I think we all have.
Yeah.
We've all had the experience of being the Buddha because we've been here for so long. So long. Your spirit has been constantly reincarnating because it's in the loop of the matrix. They show it to you in the movie. And the Vedas taught us about this. That's probably where they got it from. We've known this for millions of years. You know, that we are manipulated on a higher level.
Yeah.
But you can break free from that, you know?
Yeah, I think that's the takeaway message is the, you know, some of the things that we're carrying around with us energetically, it runs deeper than we could ever imagine. But what a privilege to be able to work through it in this lifetime and remember who we are and wake up in the matrix. And the work that we do, it's not just for us either. It's for the subsequent generations of humanity, that we no longer have to pass on our toxic genes and toxic blood and our subconscious beliefs and our emotional wounding, that, you know, those beings can come in with a cleaner slate because of what we've done to improve ourselves. So any final thoughts, Brian? And you can let people know where they can find you and what kind of offerings you have right now as well.
Thank you for asking. Well, I'll give my final thoughts after I say get this silly stuff out of the way. My website is quantumfitness.org. My Instagram handle is breathverse with an underscore in the middle. So breath_verse. I'm not really on any other social media except for Instagram and my own website. And I work with people one-on-one. I also have a platform that I've created that's got, you were on it. You did one of the programs.
Yep.
And it's got 8 different programs on there. And it's only $33 a month. Because I want, if I'm going to, everything I learn, I've tried to put into video, and then you make it affordable for people, so that's how I can give back. So there's a tremendous amount of information on there. You could spend a year on there and spend very little money. And I even have a program that's a 6-month breathing program. So it teaches you how to assess yourself, takes you all the way through to become a master breather, and then the brain program. So you can learn brainstem breathing. There's a movement program on there. There's a diet program. And that's how I work with people, because now I'm taking all those roads and I'm molding them to my road. And this is how I express myself. And I appreciate anybody who joins the platform or hires me as a coach, because I give my all. And then my final words, it's always hard to, you know, talk about what you have. So I try to make it accessible. And then I also have a private Telegram group that goes with that. So then people can answer questions for life. So like, we're all family. So once, you might even do 1 month of 33, but if you join the group, you're in the group for life. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't even think of telling people to leave. Right? I'm trying to create a heart-centered community. Like you said, how eloquently you said about the space we're moving into. So I want to contribute to that. And my final words are that you have to learn how to master your nervous system, because you don't realize how stimulated you are. And there are really concrete things that people can do that can help them create harmony, to keep it very simple, because we've already gone into the science. So living a more harmonious life, when you wake up every single day, you just feel better because you're working your nervous system, and good feelings naturally come on. You get natural dopamine and serotonin and those kind of hormones. They naturally come on, and that's where living high is, because your pneumogastric nerve, your vagus nerve, is sensing not only what's in your belly, but the energy around the belly, which is where fear is held. So that pneumogastric nerve is going to tell the rest of the body that it doesn't feel safe, because it's having trouble on a physical level with your gut, and on an emotional level with your dantian, your power center, right, on the chakra level.
Yeah.
So I guess what people should learn most is to breathe through their nose. Make sure that you learn to become a nose breather. Tape your mouth at night, because you're probably breathing through your mouth every single night. And if you start taping your mouth, you will feel light years different, although it could be also hard in the process. I had a student who took it off for like 3 months. I was like, what? He's like, yeah, I go to bed with it on, but it comes off still. And that's just the brain saying, see, the brain will say, oh, I need more air. So it has to switch to the emergency, which is mouth, because it doesn't know how to breathe through the nose anymore. That's where restorative breathing comes in. So I really do think the most important thing that people can do is learn how to breathe the right way, because it'll change your life, and it happens fast. You're going to start feeling better in 2 weeks. And other than that, is to not judge people, because they're going through what they're going through because of their emotional and physical traumas. And then we don't have to take that on. We don't have to contribute to that. We don't have to become triggered by that. And when you live in meditative flow, you're not triggered by other people's actions, because you see yourself as truth. And you can see somebody when they're not living their truth, and you feel compassion for them instead of lashing out at them. So then you're not affected by what they say. I don't think I've ever described it that well before. That just flowed out of me.
That's great.
That's how I lived my life. And now that I'm on the other side, I can articulate it like that. And I'm like, oh, did I just say that?
Very powerful. Well, Brian, I just want to thank you for taking the time to come on the show. It's been a real privilege to have you on and to be able to pick your brain and hear your wisdom. So thank you for everything you've shared today. I think people are going to find this incredibly valuable.
The privilege was all mine, Chad. Thank you for inviting me on, and thank you to everybody out there. And I hope this information resonates with you. And if not, that's okay. You're living your journey, and it's okay. No matter what, it's always okay.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us, everyone. We'll be back with more soon, and we'll see you then.
Peace and love.